attach them to blocks of wood that were floating and attached to maybe anchored channel. So they were up off the bottom this high, so the urchins couldn't get to them. So we had these little
holdfasts would go down.
Holdfasts would go around, pretty much just around the block. It didn't go on down usually. But what you had was
spores.
Yeah, and it worked so well. Really interesting to watch, and the best part of it was to see the change in the plants and animals in the area. Oh, abalone was the most dramatic. When we started, the abalone were these very punched shell abalone. And
the switch on the top.
I don't know. You're you could end up finding them. So I don't know. We didn't do anything. I don't think there was any basic work. We actually had
check one, two
transects that we worked on for 5 years, and we kept track of the data.
We'd like to ask.
I don't think the data would be published. It'd be a great data set to get hold of. Ken Wilson, Santa Barbara, probably has that. But anyway, the abalone, once we got the kelp established, you could see the abalone start to grow faster, and you could see the shells flattening out. So you'd have these abalone with these big flat shells and a big kelp in the middle.
Did you ever see it?
It's just slow. It was just slow. Okay. We'd like to ask you to please take your seats. We'll get started in just about a minute or two.
One, two, one, two, one, two.
Say again, they're important because
party way,
which means
you got water right here.
I know, but I want cold water.
Nah, I got it. Yeah, I'm good.
Good morning, how are you?
The handouts are in here, so
this is where the equipment is here.
So, just so to crystal clear, which way does this go?
This button makes it go
back. Can you make it go back?
Yeah.
Okay, alright. Alright.
Too much coffee this morning.
No, I know. Did you get your water?
Yeah.
I'm all watered up now.
Alright.
Yeah, they are. I got so many pairs. Yeah, that's they look familiar.
Exactly.
Good morning, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this kickoff meeting of the Central Coast Regional Stakeholder Group for the Marine Life Protection Act Initiative. I'm Scott McCreary. I'm the principal of Concur, and I'm one of the co-facilitators for this effort, working alongside my colleague Eric Poncelet. I have just a very few remarks I want to make by way of introduction. First of all, we very much appreciate your willingness to take part in this effort. We think it really represents a tremendous opportunity, and we'd like to start right at the beginning by setting a tone of constructive dialogue, information sharing, and valuing various points of view. And there are, I can assure you, many points of view around this table, and that will become apparent very soon. Finally, our work together is very goal-oriented. We're not here merely to have a conversation. We're here to do a lot of joint work, and I think that is the key phrase, joint work. You will see us asking you over the next 2 days to engage in three different initial tasks or initial activities to really begin the work of this regional stakeholder group. So the agenda that we've structured really has a series of objectives. We want to introduce you to each other and to project staff. We want to review and adopt ground rules to guide our work together, which we really view as a set of mutual commitments. We want to review the project goals and work plan. And as most of you know, Eric and I have spent a good part of the last several weeks interviewing you individually, and we want to present to you the findings of those interviews. There is a lot of important background information that's evident from the packet and the handouts, and we'll be giving you a number of briefings, and then we want to begin preparations for the next meeting and really launch into the work of this stakeholder group. So those are the objectives for the meeting. What I'd like to do now is to ask Phil Eisenberg to make some initial comments regarding the charge of this group and his view of it, and then we'll go ahead and review the entire agenda, and we'll hear from Mike DeLappa and about the project team, and we'll hear from each of you with brief introductions. So, Phil, go
ahead. Thank you very much. We heard in the private interviews that all of you lacked things to do. You didn't have jobs. You didn't have an active social life, and you needed your time consumed over the next 5 or 6 months. And so, accordingly, we are consuming your time, and I just want to tell you on behalf of the task force, we deeply appreciate your willingness to sacrifice what will be a considerable amount of time, a lot of energy, and a lot of effort to make this possible. You're all a bunch of experts, but just in case there might be one or two people out there who don't know what the task force is up to, let me refresh your recollection. As you know, we were created late last year by Secretary Mike Chrisman and the Resources Agency, essentially to be advisory to the Department of Fish and Game and the Resources Agency. We have 4.5 work products that we were required to do. The first was to submit a draft master plan framework to the department, and the department would then review it and submit it on to the Fish and Game Commission. That has been done. Our second deliverable is by December of 2005, to prepare and submit a recommended set of recommendations for long-term financing of marine protected area activities in the state of California. And that activity is underway, and the research and evaluation and idea collection is being done. The third deliverable that we're required to produce is that by March of 2006, the task force must consider and adopt and make recommendations to the department of a network of MPAs somewhere in the central coast of California. This body is key to us in focusing in the central coast. And as you know, at some of our prior meetings, we identified the study region from Pigeon Point up north to Point Conception down south as the collective area within which recommendations and network recommendations and considerations would be done. After we make our recommendation in March of 2006, we then spend a fruitful and productive couple of months trying to figure out how the state and federal government can cooperate together. That's more in the nature of psychiatric interaction than anything else, as best I can figure out. And then the last thing is we're supposed to make all state agencies with a finger in this pot love and cooperate with each other. That's our half-final activity. We go out of existence at the end of December 2006. So essential to our consideration is the evaluation you make and the recommendations you come up with within the Central Coast region. And we understand how difficult it is. We understand how complicated it can be. But it is essential for us to have a shot at making an intelligent decision that you do your work, you spend your time together, you battle on issues as you see fit, but come up with recommendations that we can understand, evaluate, and hopefully the alternatives you present are ones we can choose between and implement, make recommendations they be implemented. So I'm deeply appreciative for your time. There'll be task force members sitting in, if not in all of your meetings, almost all of your meetings. And no, I will not be attending all of those meetings, but other task force members and I will be dividing up that responsibility. So thank you very much. We appreciate it.
Thank you, Phil. We'd like to ask Gary Stacey if he would like to make some initial comments at this point.
About 2 weeks. I've got a learning curve about that. Thank you. but I'm really excited about this effort. You folks participating in making this work is essential for us to be successful. All of you bring expertise to the table. We're going to rely very heavily on that expertise and helping you develop.
Green light's good. And being able to develop final recommendations. On behalf of Ryan Broderick, I'd like to welcome you all here for this effort. We appreciate very much the time that you're putting into this. Your input's going to be very, very important to the final product we develop and ultimately give to the Fish and Game Commission. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Gary. What we'd like to do is take you very briefly through the agenda that we've crafted to meet these meeting objectives. I then want to ask Mike DeLappa to introduce the project team, and then we'll follow with brief introductions of everyone around the table here. So this one? Okay, so for the first 30 minutes or so, we're doing this initial introduction, agenda review, and orientation. At 10:30, we plan to introduce, discuss, and we intend to approve ground rules to guide the work of this group together. We'll then take a look at project goals and the respective roles of the regional stakeholder group vis-a-vis the science team and the Blue Ribbon Task Force, something that many of you asked about in the interviews. We'll take lunch, and then following lunch, we'll briefly review the findings from the stakeholder assessment that we conducted. We'll then get into the first of three interactive activities, and the idea here will be to invite each of you to say a bit about your respective marine interests, your areas of expertise, and what you think you need to contribute and to and make this project a success. And that will be done with reference to a couple of large maps that will be posted or have been posted on both sides of the room, and we'll ask you to make reference to those in talking about your interests and areas of expertise. We'll wrap that up later in the afternoon, and then we'll look at some important context and background information. If you've looked at your packet at all and paged through the handouts, you can see there is a very large amount of material that staff has organized, and we've done a concerted effort to try to present that in a concise way, and we'll start that process this afternoon. We'll adjourn, and there is a group dinner at 6:30, and we'll hear more about the arrangements for that a little bit later. And then tomorrow, we'll begin earlier at 8:30. We'll begin with questions, if there are some, from today, reviewing the agenda, and then we'll continue with a look at some important context and background information. Many of you in the interviews ask good questions about what is the look and feel of the work product? What do you expect the regional stakeholder group to produce? And we're going to try and address that question head on at the 10 o'clock item tomorrow. There is also a breakout group activity later on, taking a look at hopes and fears, successes and failures, and ways to promote success. And we want you to take part in that in the second part of the afternoon, second part of the morning. Following lunch, we'll talk about actually beginning the activity of crafting goals and objectives. We'll have a presentation about a good way to think about goals and objectives, and then we want to begin engaging you in actually brainstorming what some of those might be. We anticipate that coming out of that item, we will want to appoint a work team of a cross-section of the regional stakeholder group, and so we actually want to use that work team effort to begin propelling work prior to the July meeting and really model the progress that we hope to achieve throughout. And then we'll aim to adjourn it at 3 o'clock. So that is an overview of the agenda. It's been, we think, well thought out. It's ambitious, and we'll see how we go. Mike DeLappa.
Thanks, Scott. I'm Mike DeLappa. I'm the project manager for the Central Coast region, and I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to welcome all of you and echo the remarks that Phil and others have made about how much we appreciate the time that you're putting into this. I'm just going to briefly introduce the staff that will be available to you and will be supporting the effort over the next 7 months. John Curlin, who's the executive director of the initiative over there, and Melissa Miller Henson, who handles the operations and communications at the state level, Mike Weber, who is the senior project manager, very involved with the development of the master plan. Supporting me specifically in the region will be Mary Gleason, Dr. Mary Gleason, who's the principal planner on the project, Rita Bunzel, who'll be handling communications and operations in the area, Kirk Sturm, who'll be doing outreach in Morro Bay, Don Maruska, who's been very helpful with strategic planning and bringing in the knowledge of the Marine Working Group from Morro Bay. From the Department of Fish and Game, John Ugritz, who's the lead for the department, along with Paul Riley. Paul's a three-time veteran of this center. For those of us who are one-time veterans, we give our condolences, Paul. Tony and back there with the department will be the providing expertise on enforcement. Steve Berger with the science advisory team at the state level, and within the audience, we've got a number, and also at the table, a number of sub-team members from the science group. If you could just raise your hands to indicate that you're on the science sub-team. We've got somewhere between 5 and 10 people from the science team that will be involved with us in supporting our work. So thank you.
Thanks very much, Mike. What we'd like to do at this point is, first of all, ask you who have your name tags parallel to the table to turn them at an angle so we can see them. So especially those way down there. Thank you very much. And then we'd like to begin introductions. This is really, I would say, part one of introductions. What we're looking for is something quite brief, your name, your interest group affiliation, your region, and please bear in mind that there'll be a lot more opportunity to introduce yourself at more length this afternoon. We're also wanting to send around this contact information sheet. We want to ground truth the information on it, make sure it is correct, and once we do that, we'll make this available to all of you. So let's begin with you, Darby, and just work around the table.
It's Darby Neal, out of Morro Bay, California. I own and operate Burgess Sport Fishing.
Actually, Darby, if I can interrupt for just a sec, protocol for good. Right.
Thank you. Protocol for good mic use
modeling
is apparently...
I'm allergic to mics.
The simulcast works well when we speak right into the mics.
Okay. My name is Darby Neal from Morro Bay, California. I own and operate Burgess Sport Fishing.
Steve Berger, the chair of the science advisory team. And my affiliation is with the Stanford Law School Department on environmental policy.
At the University of California at Santa Cruz and a member of the Science Advisory Team.
Tom Capon, president of the Port San Luis Commercial Fishermen Association, and I work out of Port San Luis.
David Crabb, commercial fisherman based out of Monterey for squid and pelagics, representing the local Monterey fleet.
Mike DeLappa with the initiative.
On? Yes. I'm Dave Edlin. I'm with SenCal Skin Divers. We're a breath hold diving group.
I'm Howard Egan. I'm a recreational fisherman from Santa Cruz. I represent the recreational fishermen on the north end of the region.
Eric Endersby, representing Recreational Fishing Alliance, is a diving representative. I live and work in the Morro Bay area.
Ellen Perot Daniels, I'm a marine scientist working for the California Coastal Commission. I supervise our statewide oil spill program.
I'm Caitlin Gaffney. I work for the Ocean Conservancy and Environmental Organization out of the Santa Cruz Field Office.
I'm Ray Fields with the Abalone Farm down in Cayucas near Morro Bay, and I represent the kelp harvesters in the Morro Bay area.
Tom Hafer, I'm representing the South Central Nearshore Traffic Hook Fishermen and the Spot Pond Fishermen.
My name's Doyle Hannon. I'm on the SAT, and my day job is a scientific researcher. I do marine research on fisheries and marine mammals.
Bob Hather. I represent the recreational fishing interests and along the Central Coast with the Central Coast Fisheries Conservation Coalition.
Gordon Hensley, I'm the San Luis Obispo Coastkeeper. We are the waterkeeper program on the Central Coast from Santa Maria River through Monterey Bay.
Phil Eisenberg, I'm a lawyer, a lobbyist, former legislator based in Sacramento, chair of the task force.
Eric Ponsley, an associate with Concur, the facilitation team.
Scott McCreary, facilitator. Michelle.
Michelle Knight, Adventures by the Sea, and here representing sea kayaking as well as the hospitality industry in the central, in this region, Monterey Bay.
I'm Ron Massengill from Cambria. I represent recreational fishing and conservation.
Tom Matouche, I own and operate a charter boat out of Pillar Point Harbor, Half Moon Bay. I also represent Golden Gate Fishermen's Association and the Coastside Fishing Club on recreational fishing interests.
I'm Marla Morrissey. I'm a conservation chair with the Marine Interest Group, and I also facilitate the Steelhead Recovery Coalition of the South Central California Coast.
My name is Jeremiah O'Brien. I'm representing the Morro Bay Commercial Fishermen's Organization.
I'm Linwood Pendleton. I'm an associate professor at UCLA. I'm a natural resource economist. I work in recreational fishing, scuba diving, and non-consumptive uses. I'm a member of the science advisory team.
I'm Holly Price. I represent the Monterey Bay National Marine Sanctuary, which is part of NOAA.
My name is Miloš Radakovic with Life on the Bay. I'm a marine biologist, a coastal naturalist, and guide in the Monterey or Central Coast region.
I'm Paul Riley from the Department of Fish and Game with the Scarlet MLPA letters on my back.
Mike Ricketts, Commercial Fisherman, Monterey Commercial Fishermen's Association.
Robin Robinson. I'm an artist, I'm a diver, and I'm from this area.
I'm Jesus Ruiz. Recreational scuba diving, and I'm also the state coordinator for the National YMCA School Program.
I'm Steve Scheiblauer. I'm the harbor master here in Monterey. Welcome. And I'm also representing the California Association of Harbor Masters and Port Captains, which in turn represents about 45 coastal harbors and in turn represent the waterfront interests of those entities. Thank you.
I'm Walter Schoble. I'm my airspace and offshore manager at Vandenberg Air Force Base between Point Conception and Point South.
I'm Art Seavey. I'm with the Monterey Abalone Company, and I'm representing kelp harvesters in the northern part of the Central Coast.
John Ugretz with Department of Fish and Game, and I am the lead for our marine protected area processes.
John Curlin, the executive director of the MLPA initiative.
John Wolf, I'm a volunteer diver for the Reef Environmental Education Foundation, and I represent non-consumptive scuba divers.
I'm Mary Yaklovich with National Marine Fisheries Service in Santa Cruz. I'm on the science advisory team, and remarkably, I was on the first science advisory team for phase one of the MLPA.
I'm Chris Lindstrom. Environmental consultant. I'm representing the California Association of Sanitation Agencies, which is an organization of public agencies which are responsible for managing wastewater statewide, in particular interest in the coastal zone. This panel.
I'm Rick Algert. I'm the harbor director for the city of Morro Bay, and I'm also designated to represent harbors.
Great. Did we miss anyone around the table here? I want to take note that we are 6 minutes ahead of schedule. Whether or not this ever occurs again will be an interesting question to note, but good job, everyone, being concise. I really appreciate that. What we want to do now is to turn to the ground rules. We think of ground rules as a way of creating a set of mutual commitments Okay. Maybe we aren't 5 minutes early. We do want to give alternates a chance to introduce themselves. So let's organize a way to do that. Why don't you stand and...
John Aliotti, commercial fisherman, California Coast.
Jay Elder, Port San Luis Harbor Manager, South Region Center.
Mark Chargel, I'm a marine life photographer, and for the last couple of years I've been working with a group called Coalition of Organizations for Ocean Life, which is interested in these marine protected area issues.
Mike Stellert, commercial fisherman in Santa Cruz, president of the Santa Cruz Commercial Fishermen's Association.
Jim Webb, I'm president of Cambria Fishing Club, recreational angling group in Cambria, California.
Gary Stacy, regional manager, Department of Fish and Game.
Any other alternates? Okay. Understood. A note on alternates. The intent is to have is for each primary representative to have a designated alternate. As I understand it, the nominations for the alternates closed last week, and the expectation is that all of the alternates will be fully appointed within about 3 weeks. So the process is ongoing, and we hope that we have a full population of alternates well before the next meeting. Is that correct, John? Did I hit that properly? Okay.
Good. Yes, that is correct.
All right, thanks. What we would like to do now is to turn to ground rules. And as I said a moment ago, we believe that ground rules are really an opportunity to create a mutual set of... No, we're not done yet? One more. Sorry.
I'm Carol Jones. I own and operate Tom Sport Fishing out of Moss Landing.
Thank you, Carol. Didn't mean to exclude you.
Hi, I'm Josh Mendenhall, Moss Landing, Monterey Bay Kayaks.
Okay. Melissa, do we have a complete set? Okay, good. Thank you very much, and sorry for the oversight. All right, one more try on ground rules. An opportunity to not only make a mutual set of commitments to each other, it's also, in a way, the opportunity to make an initial agreement. The ground rules that we have proposed have a couple of goals and a couple of information sources. The goals that we put forward is to encourage clear communication, respect for divergent views, creative thinking, and collaborative problem solving. And by the way, do you all have the proposed ground rules in front of you? You'll need to have them for this conversation. And we also believe very strongly that this process and the dialogue that you have represents an opportunity for you to pursue and achieve mutual gain. So that's very much the goal here. Information sources that support these ground rules are two. One important set are the interviews we did with all of you. Those of you who were interviewed, and it should be virtually everyone around the table, recall that we asked you very specifically, what should we adopt in the way of ground rules to make this process work well? And by the way, what pitfalls might we learn from or might we avoid based on past experience? And we've taken that to heart and tried to work those thoughts into these ground rules. The other very explicit source of information for these ground rules is our own considerable body of experience. Concur has facilitated probably 40 groups of this nature over the last 17 years, and we've come upon a number of procedures and wordings that work well and serve a group well. And quite honestly, we have folded that in to these draft ground rules as well. So it's really a melding of what you told us and our own experience. With respect to representation, all of you have been selected based upon a number of considerations, but importantly, your expertise and knowledge of marine issues, your ability to represent an important constituency, and very importantly, your willingness and ability to work collaboratively and constructively. And so that's key to representation. I mentioned constituencies. The expectation is that everyone around the table between meetings will check back with their constituencies. And how you do that is really up to you individually. Some of you already have, we know, elaborate email networks. Some of you, we were told, plan to convene small community meetings. Your method of checking back is up to you, but we do expect that you're here not just representing yourself, but an important constituency. It's evident that the way we've chosen to seat people today is primary participants are seated here at the table, and that includes obviously members of the regional stakeholder group, the science team, Blue Ribbon Task Force members, and some of the I-team, of the initiative team. Other participants will be seated nearby. We think this is probably a workable way to handle it. With respect to, are you on this one?
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah. Scott and I are tag-teaming going through these. We've developed several ground rules under the topic of participation and collaboration, in particular with regard to the roles of the primary and alternates. The primary members are expected to attend all of the meetings. The alternates are invited to attend as many as possible. We strongly encourage that. And there's a commitment that we expect between the primaries and the alternates to coordinate in between meetings to make sure that nothing is lost in case the primary cannot attend the meeting and the alternate will be stepping in. The ground rules encourage active, focused participation. We expect everyone to communicate their views and their interests and to participate fully. We also are asking the group to help encourage full participation to help make sure that everybody keeps the process on track and that there is not domination by one group or another. A ground rule on respectful interaction, I think it goes without saying that we want participants to be respectful of others' interests, differences in views, and to avoid any type of personal attack or stereotyping. A ground rule on integration and creative thinking. We really are asking everyone at the table to be open-minded in the discussions that take place and to think integratively. And this means when you are making a point or sharing an idea that you try to incorporate the ideas that you've heard from others at the same time. And disagreements will obviously come up in the course of the deliberations, but we ask that folks treat this more as problems to be solved rather than intractable battles. And we think that folks can work creatively together to do that. A ground rule on a mutual gains approach. This is something that Scott mentioned earlier. We were asking folks not only to express their interests, but in the discussions to try to satisfy not only their own, but the interests of others around the table. And we find this to be key toward coming to agreements in groups of these sorts. And final ground rule in the area of participation and collaboration is with regard to a commitment to the ground rules. We are asking you to commit to upholding these and actually enforcing them as well. That it's Scott and I see this as our role to enforce them, but we also find it to be extremely effective when the participants in these groups can enforce them themselves. Next, a series of ground rules on the topic of commitment to the process. We are asking everyone to make a good faith effort here to achieve the goals of the project. This means that folks are going to come prepared to the meetings and that everyone will try to be here on time and to stay throughout the course of the meetings. And if you know that you are not going to be able to either make it or be there in full, throughout the whole meeting, to please coordinate with staff so we know what your schedules are. A couple of ground rules on the topic of identifying and valuing alternatives. A key task in front of all of you is to try to identify and value alternative MPA proposals. And we're asking that you try to come up and invent some of your own, but also to be open to others introduced by other people around the table here and other ideas that may actually come from even outside of the stakeholder group itself. And by way of valuation, what we mean here is that you will be assessing these different alternatives that are proposed using best available or readily available science to see how well the particular proposals are satisfying the goals and objectives of the MLPA. Not the decision rule, Scott.
Okay. So one of the most important things that we have to discuss is how will we make decisions as a regional stakeholder group. And this is something that we got a great deal of advice about in the interviews. And here's how we parse this issue. First of all, there are a lot of small decisions that, and choices, frankly, that we need to make to propel this process forward. And in order, we might, for example, say, do we want to have a work team on goals and objectives, or do we want to have a work team on reflecting on past experience? And we might, it might be useful to sort of take the temperature of the group, and I'll ask for a straw vote, and we'll make a decision based on probably a simple majority kind of a thing. Those are just, I would deem those process decisions to move the process, to move the work of the stakeholder group forward. With respect to substantive issues, it's obviously our aspiration to reach as high a level of consensus as possible. Equally important, though, insisting on total unanimity is probably a recipe for not finishing. That seems to be the lesson from some of the past processes. It was a piece of advice that we heard very strongly in the interviews. And so we have chosen, in crafting these ground rules, to really steer a path between the thicket of 50% plus one gets the decision on a substantive issue versus total unanimity. And what we're saying is we want to strive for a definition of consensus that is as much agreement as we can reach. And we hope that's close to unanimous, but we are not insisting on it. And we think insisting on it is a mistake. So that's the ground rule that we have chosen to put forward with respect to decision rules. Now, what might the proposals look like and how might they go forward to the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the Fish and Game Commission? There may be a suite of proposals. There may be one proposal that attracts very broad support from the fishing community and much less support from the conservation community. There may be a proposal that has the opposite kind of level of support. But there may be, and this is our aspiration, be a set of proposals that attracts very broad support from everyone around the table. And that's the vision that we want to put forward here. We want to suggest that that's possible. And I would say in the interviews, people told us that sounded feasible. So that's our approach to decision rules here. Moving on to the science subteam, we expect that the science subteam members will work very closely with members of the regional stakeholder group. And in fact, we expect that they will work in perhaps small work teams on a variety of the tasks and work products that the regional stakeholder group is asked to put forward. So we do not envision a strict separation in role between science subteam member and regional stakeholder group. This is something that many of you express concern about as to whether science is too arm's length from the stakeholder group, and the intent is quite the contrary. The intent is to promote an integrative method of interaction. Related to that, we feel very strongly, and this is an idea we tested in the interviews, is that we should not reinforce existing caucuses or blocks or blocking coalitions so much as we should encourage multi-interest work teams to form and to put forward proposals. And we're going to begin modeling that activity in this meeting, in this plenary meeting, and we're going to promote that and organize it for an intervening work team before the July meeting. So we expect you to literally work across the aisle, reach across the table, share knowledge and perspectives with people that are not in your ordinary caucus or coalition. The other issue that, besides decision rule, that's a bit tricky and interesting is media contact. And we explicitly asked people, again in the interview, how shall we handle media contact? And there are admittedly different approaches to this issue. The most predominant advice we heard, and this resonates with our other experience, is that we should all recognize that posturing in the media and, frankly, negotiating through the press is counterproductive to a collaborative process like this. And prejudging outcomes or speaking for other interests is also contradictory or undermining of collaborative process. So the proposal that we've put forward is to basically ask you to avoid speaking to the press specifically about the emerging proposals and conclusions of the regional stakeholder group so as to give time for these proposals to be put together, discussed, and assembled. We further suggest that we should recognize and make use of the initiative staff in handling media contacts. And we suggest that if that's not sufficient and you feel that you really need more of a stakeholder voice in talking to the media, that we convene a multi-interest media subcommittee to write press releases, speak to the media, and in other ways complement the conversation that the initiative staff would have. That is the proposal. And, you know, there may be some conversation about that, but honestly, that does reflect the majority of advice that we heard in the interviews. So those are some of the key points. Information sharing and fact-finding. We asked all of you what information needs would support your work on this stakeholder group. A rather large amount of information has been brought forward. We anticipate that we will need to go into a mode of kind of logging information requests and figuring out how to respond to them. But I can assure all of you that staff's taken very seriously the information request that you did tell us about, and we've really strived to bring that forward in this meeting. We also recognize that people may disagree about information. That's a characteristic of scientifically complicated issues like MPA designation. And so we ask you, all of you, if you see two or more data sets that or interpretations that appear to conflict, that you try to understand the basis for the disagreement and try to clarify and narrow the basis of that disagreement so as to promote joint learning rather than getting locked into a mode of adversary science that so often characterizes a lot of our public policy debates. I realize that is a lofty aspiration, but I think it's a constructive one. With respect to the facilitation team role, we are nonpartisan. We are not an advocate for any interest group. We are an advocate for finishing the work, and we will push you hard, and we will point out opportunities to be more efficient. But we are not an advocate for any interest group around the table or any particular set of MPA proposals. To move this process along, it's our duty, which we take very seriously, to put forward a summary, which we call a key outcomes memo, soon after each meeting. These key outcomes memos are not transcripts. They are not minutes. They are just what they say. They are trying to highlight the most important points made and decisions reached, and even more importantly, assignments, mutual commitments made so as to keep all of us on track. So it is our duty to turn those around quickly. Generally, we do that within 7 to 10 days of a meeting, and we expect to be able to do that. So that is an overview of these ground rules. I anticipate that there might be some discussion about them. Eric, did you want to?
Yeah, actually, I just did two follow-ups before we open it up to discussion. One is we're asking that you all take these ground rules very seriously. But if it happens that one of the members of the group tends to deviate consistently from the ground rules, it is possible that that person will be replaced by someone else upon confirmation by the director of the California Department of Fish and Game and the Blue Ribbon Task Force chair. And then finally, we want to let folks know that while we do want to approve these ground rules now, that it is possible that if over the course of our discussions, folks think that the ground rules aren't satisfying their function of keeping the group working well together and effectively, that we can revisit them and we can change them again to make them more effective. And so in the spirit of adaptive management, we want to start this process with a good set of ground rules that everybody thinks will help the group work together well, recognizing that if we need to revisit them and change them down the road, that is possible.
Right. So our aspiration is to entertain discussion and hopefully move to adoption of these ground rules in the next 20 minutes or so. And I realize that you have not seen these before, although many of you engaged in conversation with us in the interviews about what might they contain. And I want to, first of all, ask you to go ahead and read them through if you haven't done so, and then ask if there are any questions or comments on what is proposed here. Yes, go ahead. Howard.
Yes, I have one question. It seems to me that there might be some internal conflict within the ground rules regarding checking back with constituencies and media contact. I have, and it depends on how you define the media. If media is defined too broadly, I have a charge to communicate with my constituency via a variety of ways, one of which is through interviews with fishing newspapers, radio interviews, and also reports on meetings on websites, which could be construed as media as well.
Right.
All of those are means of communicating to my constituency the status and progress of this operation.
Right.
So
that's a good point.
I think that's that needs to be thought through a little more clearly, because it potentially is going to inhibit my ability to do my job.
Right. So you mentioned different methods of communication. And you mentioned an email network, I think, when we talked.
I'm routinely interviewed on a local radio show to give status updates on what's happening in the MLPA process.
Right.
And obviously, fishing newspapers are going to want to know what's going on in this process.
Right.
And it's my duty to inform them what's going on.
The most important idea is twofold. Number one, avoid prejudging outcomes, either substantively or in terms of commentary on this group is definitely going to get there. In fact, they're going to finish early, or there's no way they're going to get there. Secondly, avoid commenting on or characterizing the interests of another marine interest group. The conservation community thinks X. The recreational fishermen think Y. Commercials think Z. Avoid that kind of characterization. So I think those are the fundamental ideas we're trying to reinforce here.
Right. That's completely understood, and I think that's reasonable. But unfortunately, that's not really what the media contact paragraph says.
That's true.
I think that needs to be reworked.
Okay. Fair comment. Yeah, Steve.
I wonder if you could say a little bit more about what the end product will look like as it's going to be delivered to the task force, and particularly, I mean, how will we or will we express the level of support? I understand the concept of trying to get as close to consensus, and it may not be perfect, but, you know, will the task force understand that 25 out of 30 of us agree to something, or will they actually be provided of those people who support a particular alternative? How will that look? And that could be a very important information for the task force to know.
So your question is, what is the method of conveying the level of support attached to different alternative proposals? It's not something that we have predetermined. I would like to ask Mike and John Curlin to comment on this, but I would observe that in other processes like this, questions of that nature sometimes are recognized and then revisited as we get kind of closer to the work product. I would also say that one method that we have used is to invite people to ratify with their signatures support for a proposal. Another is to simply list the supporters, and still another is to characterize numerically the level of support. So there are many different methods. I'm a little reluctant to recommend that we prejudge that today. Mike, what do you think about that?
John Curlin?
I would concur with the hesitation to prejudge it, and I think just identifying the range of options and ways to do it is very valuable. The important thing is to convey accurately the options and how they are understood and valued, including levels of support, to the Lure and Task Force, known up to the Fish and Game Commission. I was thinking also of what we did with the process that led up to the designation of the Central Coast Study Region, in which we had workshops and we pulled from those, and without numerically characterizing support, I think accurately the dynamics ended up narrowing the range of choices, and I think we accurately conveyed that without numerical methods. I'm not certain that will happen again, but I think the goal is the important thing, to get the options clearly understood, clearly defined, and have the range of questions about as well as support clearly communicated up. And the devices that Scott has enumerated are amongst those, I think, that would be available to do that.
So, Steve, we're recommending noting, duly noted, and punt for now, but it's important to do. Other comments? Yes, go ahead, Caitlin.
Is that on?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
First, I just wanted to agree with Howard's comments about the need to maybe take a second look at the exact language of the media contacts, because I think what you verbally explained made perfect sense. But as Howard suggested, the text is quite different and much more stringent. And just to make it very clear what the ground rules are so that we don't unknowingly violate them or think they mean one thing and other folks have a different understanding, I think that is really important. And then I had a suggestion under the commitment to process, the first ground rule on, under commitment to process on page 2, currently reads, participants will make a good faith effort to achieving the goals of the project. And I wanted to suggest that we add, on the schedule proposed. I think timing is clearly going to be a very significant issue, and being cognizant of the reality of our timeline is going to be critical to success.
Well, speaking for the staff, staff supports that idea wholeheartedly. It seems like it's very consistent with the intent of why you're all here. Right, Mike?
I would say as we go into the presentations, Caitlin, that'll be very clear that the schedule is inseparable from the goals.
Well said. Gordon?
My comment, I also had that same question that Howard brought up, and I think you got that one. I have another question about the key outcomes memoranda. Mm-hmm. Along those same lines, if that comes to us electronically, and if I guess I'm looking for some nod that that is the kind of thing we can turn around and email back out to our constituent group. Or is that an internal document only?
It's an excellent question. I think it's probably the most authoritative summary of what would have been accomplished at these meetings, and I would say it would be a lot easier for you to use that document rather than needing to recreate your own briefing memo or talking point. So I think that's a very fine proposal. Mike is nodding.
Yep.
John, what do you think?
I guess a follow-up thought to that is I typically do this kind of thing with printed agendas and enjoy putting comments in there, so maybe we should address that also, that do we want to just send them back out, or you know, without any editorial comment, or you know, within the bounds of what we'd already discussed, that it's not an opportunity to undermine or lobby or shoot at other groups?
Well, rather than sending out an annotated Torah-like version of the key outcomes memo, I would suggest that if you want to attach a cover memo, that would be the way to do that, but I would ask that the key outcomes memos keep their integrity and not be annotated. Does that seem reasonable?
Sure.
Other comments? Three of your colleagues have suggested that the media ground rules, while extremely well-intentioned, may be too stringent, and that we might wish to consider a media ground rule that permits communication with fishing newspapers, and I guess there would be an analogous environmental newsletter and so on, but that you do avoid prejudging outcomes of process or substance, and that you do avoid characterizing or speaking on behalf of another constituency. Is that, I see some nodding from those who proposed it. Are others agreeable to that? Do project staff think that's workable? Okay.
Question from Caitlin.
Caitlin.
Again, just because I do think it's important to be very clear, I don't think we should draw a line between different kinds of media, because I think it's too hard to draw that line. But if we are going to draw that line, I think we need to be clear about what it is. So
right.
I don't think there's a difference between a general circulation newspaper and an environmental newsletter or a fishing group. I don't think that makes sense to draw those lines. So let's be clear.
Okay. So let me continue the conversation just a minute. Imagine that the San Francisco Chronicle calls you up and asks you for your characterization of how this group is doing. And you very diligently try not to cross lines, but you're asked a lot of questions, very tenaciously asked questions. What do you do? And that's because that reality is going to confront you if we do relax, if you will, the media ground rule. It's a judgment call that basically we're entrusting to all of you. And is that workable? And I'm not asking it just to be rhetorical. It's a very serious question, because it's very hard to draw a line between commenting on progress and prejudging outcomes. So what do you think about that?
I think we're entrusting something much bigger than that to this group. So if we can't trust each other on something like that, I think we're going to have a hard time coming to a successful end to this process. So I guess I'm willing to take that chance with everyone. And if we commit to the intent of this media language, then I think, you know, we have each committed to that, and that's our responsibility. And if we're uncomfortable with those kinds of questions from the press, then we can direct the press to staff. But otherwise, in a situation like that, I would imagine myself saying something like, this is a challenging and difficult process, and we all need to work together to come to a successful conclusion.
And indeed, you have been interviewed already about this process. And you said something very much like that. Others want to weigh in on this media issue? Michelle?
Go ahead. Yeah, I'm glad it was the first thing that came up, because I wrote gag order. I mean, I think it sort of appears the way it's written, that it's don't say anything, and then I think we come off looking extremely secretive, and also we come off sounding very unintelligent if all we say is I need to direct all inquiries to staff. I mean, this isn't a secret inquisition. It's very important, and I think the key point is to try not to characterize what other people think. I mean, to me, that's almost the biggest issue, because we obviously are going to have disagreements, and although there are some factual statements that can be made about how you disagree, it's important not to cast it in a prejudicial way. I mean, I think that would be the biggest commitment, and I think you have to trust us to a certain extent, because that's why we're here.
I'd like to make a quick follow-up to Michelle. She does bring up the point that you may, in such contacts with the media, get questions that you really don't feel you can answer well, and you do have this option of directing those questions to the MLPA staff, which has a process in place to do that. So,
Marla.
I think what I would feel comfortable with is having something written down in case the media called me that would say something to the effect of, I have to walk the line between commenting on progress versus prejudging outcomes, and be able to direct folks to the key outcomes memo. And then what I do with outreach to my constituents is to preface what I thought the progress was with the same kind of comment, and be sure that I'm mindful of accomplishing that when I write and talk to them. But having not being caught, what I'm trying to say is not being caught off guard, having something that we all have the same that kind of prepares us for that moment, so to speak, would be helpful to me.
Okay, so the recurring themes I'm hearing are that the key outcomes memo should be regarded as something that can be shared, that probably it's more realistic to anticipate that there will be some media contact, but when that happens, people will, again, avoid prejudging outcomes and avoid characterizing the views of other constituencies, but may comment on progress. Is that sort of where we are right now? Milos?
I think what we owe our constituencies is to do a good job. And if anything, I think we should solicit input from them as far as their concerns. But I don't know that we owe any of our constituencies or the media details about the workings. I mean, in as much as this is being videocast anyway, the information is going out. But we all know one of the major needs for any media outlet is viewership or readership, and they will do whatever it takes to get people to look at their paper or channel. So being aware of that and trying to avoid the pitfalls of helping to create controversy or foster. Hopefully we're trying to unify. So when in our contact with constituents to give an overview of the process, what we're doing, how important it is, and if they have input or suggestions, that we will be the conduit for that back to the committee. But I don't think we owe them details.
Mm-hmm. And I think embedded in your comment is that, in fact, well-thought-out media contact can be an asset to the process if it's done thoughtfully. One other comment. Yes, indeed, these meetings are videocast, but there will be, I predict, many work teams, which might be in person or might be by teleconference, that will not be videocast. There will be a lot of opportunity to develop preliminary options and proposals through the process we envision, and we think that deserves some space to happen because we're asking people to invent without committing in that process. And it's very important, I think, to protect that. Mike, John, any? John Yergarech, go ahead.
One more thought to add that you may include when you redraft this is if people are being interviewed by the media, the media will often request other names for who else should we go to and talk to. And I would recommend, based on my experience in this process, that you refer them to the whole contact list as mm-hmm. opposed to an individual on the contact list mm-hmm. and don't buckle to the pressure that they will give you as to, well, you know, gosh, who's up in arms, or, you know, which fisherman's really angry, or, uh-huh. you know, I mean, I could always point to Art and say, well, gee, he's a real, you know, high-stress guy, and you want to talk to him, but that's not fair to everybody in the process, and if they continue to pressure, I'd say in that case go to staff and refer it to the staff to give recommendations.
Good suggestion. By contact list, do you mean the roster of RSG
members, correct. Okay. And I believe there will be a contact list. I don't know if the group has decided if that will be public or not. So that's something to consider as well.
Okay. Good. It seems like we're converging on a slightly recast ground rule here, and I think this is a very productive conversation. I also want to observe that sometimes putting forward a ground rule that seems well-intentioned and then having the conversation almost serves the purpose of the ground rule. And I'm hoping some of that may have just happened. Mike, did you want to add anything?
No, I was just agreeing with what you said.
Okay. Milos?
Just one tiny thing, and that is, whatever we do and whoever we talk to, I think it's important to convey that until it is done, this is a work in progress, and to emphasize to whether it's media or constituents that as with any information they might get from anybody mm-hmm. to look at this as a work in progress until the final product is made.
Okay.
And
good. Thank you. We're at 11 o'clock. I would propose that we staff huddle and take back these ground rules, recraft the media ground rule, and bring it back to you a bit later in the meeting. But we really want to adhere to the agenda, and I think this has been an excellent conversation. Comment back here. Use mic.
Under the participation and collaboration second bullet, everyone will participate. Does that include the alternatives? We just want to know.
It's a very good point.
And I'm making a good example of it right now. I have a question, and I'm exercising. Yeah. There's no protocol for that.
Right. No, I think it's an excellent question. It's not explicit in the ground rules, and I am going to punt to staff. Mike, John, what is your inclination here?
Well, my sense is that the alternate should have the opportunity to participate in the discussions.
Meaning plenary?
Meaning clarity, questions, things like this.
Plenary and work teams. Yes? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Okay. I suggest that we...
With one exception. I mean, I think we as we move toward decisions, processes, we need to clarify who, and this comes to Steve Schleibauer's question, how do we sense whether you're doing straw votes or whatever?
Oh, yeah.
We need to clarify who has the capacity to do that. That's an issue not only for alternates, but as we see the science sub-team integrated into
point.
The group here at the table and we'll be participating in work groups also don't have a formal decision-making role.
Okay. So we need to clarify.
Nor do staff.
John, you go ahead.
One thing that actually did work in past processes was allowing primary members the opportunity to request a caucus. That
sure.
gives them the chance not only to talk to their alternate in the middle of a discussion, but also any stakeholders that are there at the meeting or people, you know, that they have to make a phone call to get some information from. I think that's something nice to build in.
Okay. So there are three potential changes to the ground rules we've noted. One is recasting the media ground rule. Another is more clarity on role of alternates, and a third is the potential for caucusing. I do want to respect our agenda here and pretty much wrap this up for now and suggest that staff take this offline and bring back a slightly revised ground rules for your consideration. Tom, did you have a final comment?
Regarding the agenda, if there's an item that one of us wants to bring up that really isn't on the agenda, when would it be appropriate to bring that up? Is it going to be an open comment period or what?
Well, I would say that to the extent you can anticipate it ahead of time and get it on the next meeting's agenda, that would be preferable. So that would be kind of first choice. And I would say that project staff, Mike, probably would be the note on that.
So what's the process of getting something?
And then, in terms of agendizing something that's not listed, I would suggest that you approach project staff and we see how we can fit it in. We've crafted this agenda pretty carefully. There may be a couple of little time caches later on that we can use, but I would suggest that you speak to project staff because the agenda that we showed you is fairly terse. I mean, there's not a lot of detail. And some of the issues that you may wish to bring up might be contemplated to be covered anyway. So I would suggest you handle it in that way.
Is there a particular project staff person who would serve as the node?
Yeah, that would be me.
Mike.
Yeah.
Mike DeLapp.
Yeah, that's a good question, Tom. Thanks. All right. I thank you very much for your thoughtful review and discussion of these ground rules, and we will bring them back with a couple of revisions. We do intend to adopt them at this meeting. We're not going to roll it to the next meeting, and we want to set a good example and propel this project forward. At this point, we want to review project goals and roles. As I said, many of you asked questions or expressed lack of complete clarity on this when we did the interviews. Staff has taken this very much to heart, and Phil has already spoken to some extent about this, but I believe, are you going to cover more about the initiative goals and roles at this point? You are not. Okay. All right.
Mike DeLapa, you'll certainly have time during my presentation. If I can get the mouse.
Yes.
The elusive mouse.
Yeah, let's see
if I can figure this out. Oops. No, that's just my notes.
Okay.
Can you get this?
We need to have an AV moment here, I guess.
Okay, so I'm going to spend about 15 minutes just briefly covering the project goals and roles. This is really an overview. I think a lot of you have probably heard this two or three times before, but for those of you who haven't, it's just a quick introduction to the Act. I want to set the context
for the policy framework that we're going to be working in, talk about the Central Coast Planning Region, provide you with an overview of the Act, some of the key goals and objectives of the Act, talk about the various actors that are part of the MLPA initiative, and describe what the initiative is, talk about the specific Central Coast planning process. I'll be covering this tomorrow, actually, in quite a bit more detail, but I wanted to touch on it today. Getting to Steve's question of deliverables, talk briefly about what the deliverables will be out of this, and also the critical concept of adaptive management, which you've heard in relation to the process, but it also applies very specifically to the Act. So the fundamental simple reason of why we're here is to complete a legislative and gubernatorial mandate. As Phil said, we've got this year to develop and to deliver to the Blue Ribbon Task Force alternative proposals for marine protected areas. So our job will essentially be done in January. The Blue Ribbon Task Force will then begin deliberating. It will go to the Fish and Game Commission next year for their consideration. But there's some other, I think, factors that are also important to bring us together. Really, I look at this as a very exciting opportunity to do something that's quite unique, protect and restore the marine resources that we have here for future and current generations. That's a big, broad opportunity. Really, the reason you as stakeholders are here is because of your critical local knowledge, your ability to provide expertise on fishing and diving and marine resources and recreation and a whole variety of uses and the way people enjoy the marine environment. To share that knowledge, to build productive relationships with one another, because there will no doubt be other efforts, both on the MPA side and related to marine resources, where you'll be working with one another, and we see this as an opportunity to get started on that. And finally, to put forward a set of alternative proposals that need broad-based support. Why we're not here, and this is also something that was addressed in the charter that you all have, that is really the directive. We're not here to debate whether MPAs are useful. The Marine Life Protection Act has passed. That's a debate that should have taken place and did take place then. We are really required and charged to protect the existing array. We're not here to debate the validity of MPAs as a fishery management tool. Fisheries management is not the primary goal of the Marine Life Protection Act. And as I get into the specific language of the Act, I think that will be clear. To debate the master plan framework, we see that as a guiding document that is going through its own process now through the Fish and Game Commission. And just also to be clear, we are not making a final binding decision. That's the responsibility of the Fish and Game Commission, and they'll get input from us and from the Blue Ribbon Task Force at the state level. So to set the context, the Central Coast region is about 210 miles. It includes the state waters that go out roughly 3 miles, except in places like Monterey Bay where they go 12. To put this in context, the coastline in general in California is, not including San Francisco Bay, is around 1,100 miles, and an important ecological dividing point at the state at Point Conception, if you look from Point Conception north, it's about 485 miles. So we've got a very healthy piece of waters, roughly one-fifth of the state, not including San Francisco Bay. The policy framework, and my colleague Mike Weber is going to talk about this in quite a bit more detail in terms of the policy and legislative context, but it's just important to be mindful that there are a lot of new pieces of legislation that have passed over the last 7 years, the Marine Life Management Act, the Marine Life Protection Act, the Marine Managed Areas Improvement Act, and the California Ocean Protection Act. There are other laws that passed previously, the Coastal Act, Clean Water Act. And there are people here, John Ugritz and his staff, and I think Chris Lindstrom, who are intimately familiar with those laws and how they apply to marine resources. So we'll be drawing on them throughout this, and others of you who are familiar with the policy framework as well. The Marine Life Protection Act really is our guiding charge. It's really what we will measure everything against. It requires an improved network of marine protected areas. It requires the protection of marine life and habitats, and it defines different types of marine protected areas, marine reserves, marine parks, and marine conservation areas, and I'll talk about those in a little bit more detail. I want to just be clear about the legislative goals, and these are verbatim out of the Act. To sustain, conserve, and protect marine life populations, including those of economic value, rebuilding those that are depleted, improving recreational, educational, and study opportunities in a manner that's consistent with protecting biodiversity, protect the marine natural heritage, including habitats for their intrinsic value, ensure that MPAs have clearly defined objectives, effective management, adequate enforcement, and are based on sound scientific guidelines, and to the extent that it's possible to manage the MPAs as a network. So these are, you know, the legislative goals. These were passed by the people of California, and this is really, again, what we measure our work against. The Marine Life Protection Act initiative is a rather unique public private partnership that sprung out of the Marine Life Protection Act. There is a memorandum of agreement between the state and the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation, which defines very specific objectives and timelines. And these are, again, something that we are operating under as part of our charge and the regional stakeholder group as part of its charge and goals. As you know, the master plan framework is in process. A plan for long-term funding is also being developed. Charge number three is what we're working on here. There are two other efforts that are underway, which is coordinating with federal agencies and working to get commitments from state agencies. So there are a lot of different elements to what we're doing. We're not trying to do it all. I just want to, again, put this in the context of other things that will be going on, things that John Kerlin and people will be working on at the state level that we'll be seeing but won't necessarily be part of our day-to-day working. There are a variety of different actors that you should be aware of. The Resources Agency and the Department of Fish and Game, they'll be really giving the recommendations to the Fish and Game Commission. The Fish and Game Commission is the decision-making body in this case. The Blue Ribbon Panel is a specific the task force has been specifically chosen by the Secretary of Resources to provide advice in this area. So I think it's fair to say that they'll be given, their recommendations will be given considerable weight. You will be providing firsthand knowledge in this region, and there'll be other regions considered. But you know, you were chosen for your knowledge and background about marine resources and the socioeconomic issues in this area. We've also got the scientific advisory team, a sub-team that will be working with you hand in hand. And these are people that have specific knowledge of the science and can apply that to our task at hand. My staff and other people from the Department of Fish and Game and other federal agencies will be able to provide advice, and we can bring them in as we need them as questions come up. The public is going to be certainly participating, and people from the public, I'm sure, will be offering input and information. And finally, the Resources Legacy Fund Foundation is the organization that arranged the funding from the various nonprofit entities. So, you know, they are an actor in this process. Let me just explain how these different groups will be interacting. On the left column, you can see there's regional input, statewide input, and policy review. And across the top are different roles that the groups play. There's advice, direction, specific recommendations, decision, and implementation. So the regional stakeholder group in the left quadrant will be working directly with the Blue Ribbon Task Force. We'll be getting advice from the scientific advisory team and others. The Blue Ribbon Task Force also has a statewide interest group, and they will be getting feedback from them as well, because this is clearly part of a statewide process. There are a lot of things that we do here that will influence what happens in other areas, and so there's important precedents, and there's also important state perspectives that will be represented. Again, I'm going to talk in detail about the planning process quite a bit more tomorrow, but you can think about it in three phases. There's regional MPA planning. We're going to be kicking that off at this meeting. In that effort, we'll be developing a regional profile, looking at the ecology, the socioeconomic characteristics of the region, developing specific goals and objectives, measurable objectives, looking at the existing network of MPAs and determining whether or not they meet those objectives, and coming up with a preliminary list of MPAs. We will then do some specific work looking at individual MPAs, developing profiles and objectives for those, looking at different types of designations for them, and conducting some impact analysis. And then we'll be putting those together in various packages. This is not an entirely linear process. There'll be a lot of interaction, a lot of effort. The regional goals and objectives will be critical in really helping us determine whether everything we do meets the goals of the Act. So, I just encourage you to be, keep in mind that's a really important part of what we're going to do. I should also say that if you're interested, the master plan framework has many more pages of detailed description of this, but this is kind of a high-level summary. Well, what do we expect at the end of this process? I think in December we will have a number of deliverables. We'll have a regional profile, and Paul Riley is working on a draft right now. We'll have regional goals and objectives. We will be have an evaluation of all the existing MPAs and other management programs. We will identify potential MPA locations, proposals for individual MPAs, packages of those MPA proposals coming together, an evaluation of those packages, and then all that will be put together into a regional management plan with other detailed information about enforcement, monitoring, other things that have to do with this process. And you'll have a chance to see and comment on those programs as well. I wanted to just touch on the concept of adaptive management because it's really critical to what we're doing. The rationale for adaptive management is that the marine system is very complex. It changes. It's a dynamic system, and our understanding of it is not static. We learn things all the time. So the expectation in the Act is that as we learn, we adapt the management system to be more responsive and to be more specific to the goals and objectives that we have. So it's critical that as we do this, we have measurable objectives, so that as monitoring and evaluation plans are developed and implemented, they can really tell us whether or not the MPAs and the collection of MPAs are meeting those goals, and if they're not, developing a process and revisiting the management plan. As part of adaptive management, there's also a requirement for a communications plan, outreach to the various interest groups and people that are here today to get their input. And finally, it's anticipated that collaborative monitoring be part of the process. People that are out on the ocean, that are spending time there, either fishing, diving, watching things, observing, can all be part of this network of data collection that feeds back into the adaptive management. So let me just conclude. We do have a fairly significant challenge. I think it'll be maybe a little bit clearer tomorrow when I go through the detailed steps. We've got 7 months of hard work, but fortunately it's just 7 months. Our success will be alternative proposals of MPAs, a management plan, including detailed description of adaptive management, and we will get this done and presented to the Blue Ribbon Task Force by January 2006. So we have an opportunity. I should probably ask John Ugritz or Mike Weber and others who John Kerlin, if you have any comments before we open it up to questions. Okay, I'm happy to answer any questions you might have about why we're here today and for the next 7 months. Yes.
Yeah, I just don't understand. I'd like some clarification on the concept of alternative proposals. I'm not clear on what that means.
Alternative proposals are collections of individual MPAs and different MPA types. So, for example, there are three different types of MPAs, marine reserves, parks, and conservation areas. So you could imagine going down the Central Coast having different areas designated both spatially and by those types, and having different packages of those alternatives presented to this group. And it may be that one has 5 MPAs that are this type or 10 that are this type, and it will be that collection of individual MPAs that are put together in a package that we'll be recommending. So the idea is that package needs to be consistent with the goals and objectives that we look at. John?
think perhaps further to help clarify, we're not expecting this group to deliver a single option to the task force or the commission. It's alternative options. So you may have several of those packages that Michael described, and that's, again, alternatives. And really, in the fish and game decision-making process, they require alternatives. We don't just bring them a single option. We bring them an option and alternatives to that option. Steve.
Yes, regarding the adaptive management slide that you had, am I understanding correctly that we're going to be basically defining adaptive management as applies to our process, during our process, and that, well, for example, I'm aware there's other implications and other definitions, considerations, what have you, in adaptive management that things were on your slide. So we'll have an opportunity to really fully flesh
yes.
that out and add to that?
Yes, absolutely.
Thank you.
By what measure will we be able to determine whether the alternative submitted will meet the goals?
Meet the goals and objectives of the Act?
Yeah, right. Exactly.
I think that's part of the dialogue we will have as a group. There will be there are a couple answers. One is we will have scientific information that guides us and helps give us some ideas about whether the work that we're doing is meeting those goals. So using the best available scientific information, we will have a judgment there. We'll also have a judgment by by the members of this group about whether they feel it's meeting those goals and objectives. And certainly I think the master plan framework provides pretty detailed description of what we're expected to put together. So, again, when I talk about this tomorrow, you'll see the kinds of information, scientific information, socioeconomic information, we'll be bringing into this process, and it's quite considerable. And, that will provide what we hope is an objective standard to determine. But there will be a judgment. I mean, it's not, there is a judgment there. And ultimately, the Fish and Game Commission will make that final judgment. Holly?
Can you explain next spring, after the proposal has gone to the task force, it then goes to Fish and Game, to the department, for some level of evaluation? Can you explain what the department envisions during that interval before it's packaged for the commission?
I think John Ugritz can answer that for the department.
One of the things the department is tasked by the Act to do is to determine a preferred alternative. We are required to bring a preferred to the commission. So one thing we will do with the recommended options is choose which one we want to present as a preferred along with all the others, and all the others will go in the package. Another step that the department has added actually to this process is a feasibility analysis, and we will be assisting with that feasibility analysis to make sure that any alternative brought forward by this group is actually implementable with regards to enforceability, funding, monitoring ability, etc.
Good. Mike Weber.
There is one other step at the departmental level, and that's the peer review of the document. So that will be another thing that will go on after the packages leave the task force.
Other questions? Rick?
Rick. Yeah, thank you. I've had a lot of questions going through my mind, similar to Bob Hathers, about how we will evaluate whether we're succeeding or what might be criteria we could judge on. To keep ourselves on track, and it strikes me, I maybe ask for a reaction, in your report, you made a comment that the MLPA was debated already and is done. I'm not so sure I agree. It may have been debated in Sacramento. I'm not so sure how wide the debate was within the state, but it is done. It's a fact. And you listed the mandates from the legislature, and to me, it strikes me in your presentation, that should be our mantra. That's what we need to achieve, and I'd like to see that highlighted. Those mandates, that should be our evaluating criteria.
Yes. The goals, exactly. Everything that we do measured against those goals. But I think to Bob's point, those goals are not they're not necessarily specific and measurable. And so there's going to be a judgment made by this group and others about the, you know, how many areas, what kind of areas, you know, the you know, that collection about whether it's meeting those goals. Other questions? John?
Yeah. The department will select a preferred alternative based on science and stakeholder interests and so forth. Does the department also have the authority to amend the preferred alternative?
Let me just add, we could also develop, this group could also have a preferred alternative. So to Scott's point earlier, it could be envisioned that one alternative package that comes out of here would have the most support. That, I believe, would make the department's job a lot easier. However, it's not required in this group. So I think John and the Fish and Game Commission, if the region and the people here could come together with a specific preferred alternative, that would be fewer headaches in their life.
Did you and the second part to the question was, can we amend or change alternatives? And certainly the department could provide the commission with our own alternative. That's possible. Similar to what Mike was saying is the higher level of agreement and support that this group comes to makes our job a lot easier and makes it actually very difficult for us to change things. If you all bring forward something that every single one of you supports, it's very unlikely that we would change or recommend anything different.
Good. Yes, go ahead. Chris.
Michael, you're going to be elaborating tomorrow on how far into the future you're looking at forecasting events and activities and land use to go into your master plan? Or is that in the framework? Does it specify guidelines on, like, looking at local general plans and changes in land use and things like that?
I think Mike Weber is going to talk a bit about the land side and the various programs that go on. Mike, do you want to speak about how general plans and so on are considered in this process?
One of the requirements of the master plan framework is to identify non-fishing activities that may compromise MPA resources, and that includes activities on land. And so as part of the regional profile, the staff will be developing material for you all to consider regarding those various activities and what their impact might be. And so we're going to do our best job to be able to draw that land-sea connection for you all. The degree to which we'll be able to identify direct impacts from landside activities is going to depend on the area and the level of information. But that's what I'll be talking about this a little bit later on, about what we've set out to do to provide information to you all on those connections.
Thanks, Mike. Steve? Yeah.
Yeah, if I can maybe add to, in a constructive way, both the comments from Rick Algard and Bob Hather and Mike, I would hope maybe that we'd also really focus on the legislative findings and declarations of the Act, which kind of give us the picture of what we ought to be doing. And particularly I note item C, coastal development, water pollution, and other human activities. Seems like that's really the range of things that we're talking about, and hopefully that is another context to put what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. John Curlin?
I wanted to support the attention to the Act as the ultimate goal we're trying to get to, but also observe that the process we're going to go through, in my judgment, and our facilitators can help on talk about this also, I trust. The very first stage is identifying options and what I call valuing them, figuring out the pros and cons. And if the outcome is a preferred alternative, that's very good. But that will be required at some point. But pushing for that goal. It's a timing issue, in my judgment, and so thinking about that as an ultimate outcome would be very beneficial, but that's not June's work or July's work.
Right. Just to kind of touch back on some of the questions regarding the contents of the Act and the attention to land use and coastal development, and this is a question for project staff, do you contemplate that one of the elements of this stakeholder group's work could be advice on those issues, on those sources of impacts to the marine environment? Would that be welcomed or viewed as extraneous by project staff?
I think it would certainly be welcomed. I mean, the extent to which we're collecting lots of data now and making that deeply part of the process, the planning process, if we have more data or more information that we're not aware of that you can bring to the table and share with us, that would be very much appreciated, particularly as I think as Steve pointed out, if it relates to ocean pollution, areas that are going to affect MPAs. Mike Weber?
Yes, I was just going to add that the master plan framework calls for recommendations to other agencies regarding non-fishing activities that may affect MPA resources. So that can be part of a proposal coming out of this group, specific recommendations.
Good. Thanks, Mike. Chris?
As part of this group's charge, if we come up with identified needs for interagency coordination, training, funding, things like that, shall we put them forward?
Yes.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. And you'll see this when we talk about our stakeholder findings this afternoon, but there was a great deal of interest in making sure that this process is cognizant of the many policy directives and programs, both on the books and maybe not sufficiently implemented in California that affect marine resources. Nearly everybody we talked to brought that up, so I think there's a lot of interest in this around the table. Other questions for Mike about his presentation?
I think we're ahead of schedule again, Scott.
How about that? Take us on a field trip or something? All right. Yes, go ahead. Tom.
How does this group, the stakeholder group, how are we going to get our hands on this best available science, like, for instance, in the existing marine protected areas before we can make a and identify a problem before we can make a responsible
right.
Suggestion on where we should establish an MPA.
Right.
It doesn't work.
So Tom's question is, how can we make operational this highfalutin, good-sounding idea of best readily available science, and are we going to have it in order to do this assessment, in order to do our job? A fine question. It came up repeatedly, and I think staff are going to begin answering that in this meeting, but does anyone want to start answering him now?
I'm happy to take a quick stab at it. Mary Gleason's presentation tomorrow will provide an overview of all of the data that we have our hands on now, the data that we're expecting will be collected as part of this process, including new socioeconomic data that we're hoping. It'll describe, I don't want to steal Mary's thunder, but some techniques that we're going to use to share that information and to get feedback with you. So we're spending quite a bit of time and resources. Yes. And is Chris Ball here? Chris, I apologize. I should have introduced Chris earlier when I was introducing the staff. Chris is part of the Geographic Information System team that's assigned specifically to this project to pull together a wide variety of data sets, and those will all be publicly available and used as part of this process. And I think Mary will cover this quite a bit more tomorrow. John?
And don't forget that the subteam of the science advisory team is specifically tasked with answering your scientific questions. So if this group comes up with a specific topic or idea or data source that they need explained, that's what that team's here to do.
Steve?
I guess I have a question about the role of the science subteam. Considering that we may well have different subteam members here at each meeting, and considering that they may not agree or they may disagree amongst themselves as the SAT, And, of course, even outside the SAT, there may be other opinions, scientific opinions or studies unfolding and what have you. How will we resolve those questions about whether or not the information we're getting is peer-reviewed and fully vetted and what have you, even if it's about data? Even data can have interpretations to it. How will we resolve that in the very short time frame that we have to do all this work?
Yeah. I have a suggested way forward and maybe a clever strategy to deal with our time surplus. I think there'll be some initial comments here. I wonder if we could ask Steve to move his tomorrow presentation to now, and then tomorrow, in the slot he was going to use then, we could bring back the ground rules. Could you do your presentation on really short notice?
No. Let me...
Darn.
Let me comment on that point. I think when Scott said that on some issues we're going to have straw votes just to keep the process moving along rapidly, and then when there are substantive issues, we're going to bump them up to another level and then have a formal voting process on them. I think we can follow the same sort of guidelines with the science team. In general, there'll just be a free flow of information, but when we identify one of these substantive issues, then it'll actually get bounced to the science advisory team formally, and we'll have a chance to put together what material we have. And then regarding the best readily available science, sometimes that's a set of probabilities and uncertainty. So
that's right.
As we go through this process, there are going to be lots of situations where nobody has the answer, perfect information, and we're just going to have to state clearly what we don't know. And hopefully we can do that.
Jesus?
Yes, this is the second time we've mentioned voting or straw vote regarding issues. And I'm wondering whether that's going to be down in a proportional representation casting of the votes or straw voting.
Well, the proposal that we have incorporated in the ground rules is sort of on two tracks. With respect to making small process decisions about how we use time and things of that nature, I would just look for a straw vote and try and gauge the sense of the room and you know, probably go with something a little bit more than majority vote and just declare a decision and move forward. With respect to substantive proposals, I think it's very important that we do something much more rigorous than majoritarian voting, and that we strive for as much agreement as we can get. And so that is how I would propose to handle that. On small decisions like how should we use time, should we take a break now, should we have lunch early, you know, I don't think we need to get too concerned about proportional representation on those kinds of issues.
But you understand the underlying of my question. The representation on the Central Coast regarding stakeholders?
Yes.
Okay, thank you.
There is, and we'll talk about this again in our review of findings, that there is various levels of concern about whether we have parity, exact numerical parity or not, and whether we need it or not. And we recognize that there are different views on that, and that's why we try to parse the ground rules into these two different tracks. And really, if you're striving for something much greater than 50% plus one, then exact numerical parity becomes much less important. We're not a Congress. We're a deliberative body that's here to render advice, and to the extent we can come together and coalesce around broad-based proposals, that's what we should do. Caitlin?
Yeah, I had a question coming back to the issue of how do we know if we're meeting the goals and objectives of the Act? And I think the answer was, you know, part of that is discretionary. We're going to have to give it our best judgment, and part of that is based on science advice. And I guess my question is whether we plan to build in some kind of basic scientific briefing for this group so that we're all starting from a level playing field in terms of understanding of MPA science, so that we don't have to sort of wait till we get a problem and then ask the scientists, you know, are we on the right track, but instead we all start with a basic level of understanding of what they're likely to tell us, do our best job, and then check in are we going to have that kind of briefing provided early in the process, recognizing, you know, we don't have a lot of time to spend on issues like that?
So project staff, how can we build the capacity and level the playing field around the table before we get to tough decisions? How can we bring science in early? What's the thinking on that, John?
The thinking is that we are going to make a good shot at it, and it's going to be a good shot and not perfection. Part of the challenge is, and let me tell you first the challenges and then a thought about what we're going to try to do. The challenge is quite a bit of variation in existing knowledge. And also it's important to understand that the Act requires that we incorporate not only science but existing local knowledge. And in areas where there is not, many times they'll be complementary, and I suspect they'll rarely be contradictory. But we need to, and that's part of the reason the regional stakeholder group is very important, to bring in some existing local ground knowledge, if you will. Mm-hmm. We do need, as we prepare for the next agenda, this was an informational setting item, agenda, as we prepare for the next agenda, begin to identify areas where we can bring forward of science which is most appropriate for the decisions of that cycle, if you will, and build that over time. The other challenge we face is that there are at least four arenas in which we need to have this conversation about science, and I'm including the local knowledge as well as the peer-reviewed stuff. One is here. A second is in the Blue Ribbon Task Force. A third is in the Fish and Game Commission. And the fourth is the general public, your constituents and others. We have a fairly short time frame to do this in. I've begun conversations with the chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force, Phil Eisenberg's, Steve Berger from the Science Advisory Team, and others about how we can best provide information to these various arenas in a way that is timely, supportive, not conflicting, et cetera. We don't know the answer to that yet. But we do know, for instance, that we're going to be doing some work at the Blue Ribbon Science Blue Ribbon Task Force in our next meeting in July. We will again do video casts. It is my personal judgment that we're going to need to do more than that to bring the information back to the regional stakeholder group and to the Fish and Game Commission and others. I've had conversations with two or three people about the possible usefulness of written decision framing documents and short PowerPoints or things, so we can crystallize some of this issue, some of this information. We're right now in a process of discovery on it. But as we move forward through the cycle here, we will need to make information available. But as I said, we're going to be also paying attention to three other arenas, and we're going to have to find ways to share information back and forth.
As long as we're talking about science, I thought it might be premature, but as long as we're talking about it, obviously we need to use the best scientific knowledge and local knowledge. There will be times and areas where there just isn't a lot, and perhaps we can agree early on that not having a sufficient or a great deal of scientific or local knowledge on an issue will not preclude taking action, and that we should adopt the precautionary principle in following a course that is likely to cause the least harm or provide the greatest benefit based on what we do know.
So how would that relate to the notion of best readily available scientific information? How would you link those concepts?
Well, in issues that I've been involved with in the past, the fact that there may not be very much has sometimes resulted in a kind of paralysis. And so just to say we will use the precautionary principle and take a course of action that is likely to cause the greatest benefit and the least possible harm based on previous experience.
Which still embeds in it some kind of assessment and professional judgment, identifying what those courses are and whether they're feasible or not.
Right.
Other comments on the role of science? Steve, did you want to add anything else in this early stage?
Can you use your mic?
Through your question?
Thank you, Doctor. Largely, yes, except just wondering about the practicalities, the timing. You know, you mentioned taking it back to the SAT. We're at a furious pace here, and you guys are meeting once a month or so, or every other month.
Right, but we're actively emailing probably more than any of us would like to. But so yeah, we have lots of different ways of getting things done.
Yes, question back here.
Yes, and maybe Tom Caping can help me out here. Tom brought to my attention earlier, there's guidelines that have been adopted by the Pacific Fisheries Marine Council and National Fisheries Service with regards to this issue, and it's currently in use. Instead of replicating or creating a new policy or something, I think it would be wise if we looked at the Fisheries Management Council's guidelines on how they address the question at hand here with regards to MPAs. So I would suggest that we utilize the existing protocol. And Tom, maybe you could expand on what that document is.
Yeah, I've got it right here in front of me. This microphone doesn't work. So.
Can you use another one?
Oh, okay. Yeah, again.
Thank you.
Yes, it's the guidelines for review of marine reserve issues. It's a scientific and statistical committee, marine reserve subcommittee. They've developed this white paper to facilitate the PFMC when they consider establishing marine reserves, and they. One of the things I highlighted was the status quo is has to be considered I'll just read it. The status quo is in reserve proposals must pertain to the specific fishery for which reserves are being considered, as the details of that fishery matter a great deal to the conclusions that can be drawn. For instance, if the status quo is an overexploited fishery, reserves may enhance fishery yield. However, if the status quo is a fishery that is being managed close to the level at which maximum sustained yield is achieved, it is not clear that reserves can enhance yield. It's an 88-page document, and I copied maybe 5 pages of stuff that I thought was most pertinent to this. But the science always has to come before the establishment of an MPA, and a problem has to be established before the science has to show that there is a problem. So that's the guidelines that the Pacific Fishery Management Council uses before they consider an MPA.
Thanks. Don?
Yeah, I just want to ask. I thought one of the objectives was it wasn't a fisheries thing. That seemed related to fisheries issues. And correct me if I'm wrong, Mike, but we were dealing with non-fisheries issues with the goal. So I think there may be some conflict in those two.
John, you've written something. John, go ahead.
Tom brings up a good piece of information that I think the group should have, and we will provide the document to the group. It is a useful document that describes some of the background issues about marine protected areas and fisheries management. And as Don just brought up, it deals very specifically with managing discrete fisheries, which is the role of the Pacific Fisheries Management Council. The Marine Life Protection Act has somewhat different goals and objectives, right, though fisheries right. obviously come into right. play, and we need to keep considering that. So it certainly is not the perfect guidance document for this process, though it is another piece of information right. that we should provide to the group.
It certainly falls under the heading of being cognizant of other relative policy initiatives. And Tom, thanks for bringing it forward. Sure. Do you have a full copy, or do you have a web link or something you could share with staff? You've got it. John Ugarit has got it. Okay. Other comments about the role of science or about the mission of this group in response to Mike DeLapa's presentation? Yes, go ahead.
I just wanted to try to answer Steve's question too, and I'm going to answer this as a personal answer, not an answer from the SAT, and then Steve can tell us if this reflects what's going to happen in the SAT. But I think we'll follow, at least I personally will follow, a process very similar to the process that this stakeholder group will follow, and as the larger group will follow, and that is, when I do science, I will make available a comprehensive review of the literature, which would include anything that you would give me that I hadn't been able to find, that would be made available, I presume, on a website. I would make available all the data that I use and collect in a way, of course, that protects any issues of confidentiality. And then I would provide an interpretation of the data. So that's three elements, three products, all three of which will be available to the public. So then that gives stakeholders the opportunity to look at the data, look at the methods. The methods are going to be very transparent, and to make your own interpretation, which may differ from the SAT.
Thanks. Other comments? Rick, did you have your hand up?
Yeah, thank you, Scott. I guess I would wade into a tough problem, but what's important to our community and our harbors, I think, is that we can maintain a balance between protecting the environment and access and these traditional coastal-dependent industries, especially commercial fishing and other traditional cultural values to our community. And I am concerned, very concerned, when I look at the makeup of the science advisory team, that there is a lack of social science background, and especially socioeconomic information. And it gets to the point of almost being a deal breaker for my participation if we can't get the information that, you know, we need to tell us what the socioeconomic effects also. And there's a lot of extremely qualified folks on the marine biology and especially with ecosystem theory background on the science advisory team. But I'm concerned, and I guess if someone can help me there, I know there is EcoTrust, and I know there is some plans for some socioeconomic work. Let's be frank, a lot of folks view EcoTrust as Marine Protected Areas advocacy group. So I guess if you can help me with that, I'd appreciate it.
So Rick's question is, how will we bring socioeconomic information to bear in this process? Moreover, how can we bring it to bear in a fashion that's viewed as widely credible by people around the table? What are the plans to do that, and do we need to make additional plans?
Just so everybody's aware that there are three social economic scientists on the science panel. There's not just Astrid Schultz. Linwood's one of them. Mm-hmm. And the third is... why am I blanking
on
Richard Young, who's actually a harbor master in Crescent City or part of the harbor office, and a doctor in economic science. So there is expertise on that team, and we actually asked constituents about the makeup of that team, and they recommended Richard as an addition, which we added at fishermen's request primarily. Mm. So I would say that if you see a product regarding social and economic science coming out of the science advisory team that you feel there's some other type of expertise that would enhance, you need to let us know. And we can contact that person and get their input as well. Clearly, not everybody can participate on a team with this level of work, and some people can participate more from the outside. So that's definitely an option in the process.
Okay.
I also Chris. Wanted to just say that I think there's an expectation that the data that's developed in the ongoing studies and other data that's been developed is really a starting point. I mean, we have a lot of socioeconomic experts right here at the table that, you know, make their living or, you know, either consumptively or non-consumptively from the ocean. And part of what we're doing is bringing their voices into the process to supplement the data that we're collecting. So it's really, I mean, that's the sort of the purpose of this group, is to get additional information from people that have hands-on experience. And so I would say I wouldn't look to data collection as the end-all and be-all, because as Steve pointed out, you know, science there's probabilities and uncertainties. It's an evolving, you know, it's an evolving discipline. And what we need to do is take the best science we have with the best local information that we have and come to some judgments today about what we're going to do in terms of marine protected areas, realizing that, you know, as adaptive management, that may change over time as we learn more. So,
good. Go ahead, Chris.
Just a brief question for Mike. The integrating point for all of the scientific and socioeconomic information in your planning process will then be the impact assessment, or?
Well, the impact assessment, there's an impact assessment associated with the individual MPAs and an impact assessment associated with the proposals, the packages. So there's really two analyses there of impacts in terms of sort of cost-benefit analysis, I would say. So does that answer your question, Chris?
You threw me at the end there with cost-benefit analysis.
Well, impact analysis.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, impact analysis.
Yeah, because there's so many non-quantifiable values that have to be recognized.
Right.
So there'll be matrices of
positive and negative. Even if they aren't quantified in dollar terms, they'll be identified. Pros and cons.
John has some more information.
And after those analyses, which take place in this process, any proposal brought to the Fish and Game Commission is subject to California Environmental Quality Act analysis, which is a full formal review of proposals, and it would be included in that.
Okay. Other follow-up questions for Mike? No? Looks like we're early.
Great.
Good job. You want to go ahead and adjourn for lunch and reconvene at some instructions for lunch. Okay, your instructions for lunch are to mill about for 5 minutes.
Yes.
Caitlin, do you have something more substantive than lunch?
I do.
Good.
I had a follow-up question on the ground rules, so I'm wondering if I can throw that out since we have a couple minutes. I'll keep it very brief.
Okay.
My proposal actually is to combine the second and third ground rule amendment that were recommended. So there was a concern raised about how alternates could participate.
Uh-huh.
And then there was also a suggestion about caucusing.
Yes.
And my recollection, I think as John Ugratz mentioned, was that in the former version of this process, alternates were suggested to caucus as their way of communicating. So instead of expanding this group of 29 to the 58, instead that the alternates present while their primary is at the table would communicate through their primary. So, you know, pass a note, grab someone and get their attention, and that keeps the discussion at a more manageable level but still provides the alternates with a voice.
Mm-hmm.
So I would suggest that we consider combining those mm-hmm. two.
Mm. Interesting suggestion. Yeah, comment over here.
Yes, if that's the case, we can just all stay home and just email our representative.
So to follow up, does the caucusing suggestion just made undermine or minimize inappropriately the role of alternates, and isn't there something more, ways to engage alternates in a more significant way? And I actually would very much welcome the initiative staff to weigh in on these questions, since we were not involved in the initial decision to have primaries and alternates. John Ugaretz is reaching for the microphone.
We're all staring at each other.
Yeah.
I think we should discuss it a little further as staff. However, I don't necessarily feel that having caucuses at the meeting is the same as saying stay home and don't participate. I feel that that actually is asking for some more active participation at the meetings. I also don't feel that we should disallow alternates from speaking at the meetings. I think just as you've done today, they're here, they have important questions and comments, and there are appropriate times for that. So I think the facilitating staff can help develop that process as we move forward.
Right. I mean, I think that the other ingredient that wasn't addressed, Caitlin, in your suggestion just now is, shall we include alternates in invitations to participate in work teams? Because that would, in fact, increase the pool of potential work team participants to near 60, if you take it to its logical conclusion. you know, maybe I'm suggesting maybe with initiative staff we huddle on these points and come back to you with a revised set of ground rules to try to take this into account. But I definitely get that there are different views on this around the table. I appreciate that. Milos, did you have a comment? No? Okay. Yes, go ahead.
Thank you. I certainly recognize the potential for legislative gridlock verging on chaos as the number of participants moves towards infinity. But to respond to your point about the working groups, let me also point out the benefit of having additional brains in these working groups, in that part of what we're been tapped to do is to provide local knowledge.
That's right.
And that you get additive, perhaps even multiplicative value of increased local knowledge by being able to tap the additional brains represented by the alternates.
You know, this may have the character of our discussion about media, in that we've, you know, sort of talked a little bit about pros and cons. We recognize, certainly we value, I think your point's excellent about bringing in local knowledge and expertise. We also want this process to work. So we need to, I mean, mechanically and logistically. So we need to strike a balance. And maybe as self-selection occurs for these work teams, there can be a sort of mindfulness of what other person is available from your interest group with your expertise as people step up and as we compose these work teams. I think, like a little bit like your Steve's question a bit earlier about how will we convey level of support for various alternatives, I think we're going to need to be a bit adaptive about this. But I think we need to come out in the ground rules with a clearer statement, and I recognize the point you're making. Milos?
I think as long as we have members and alternates, it's important to have alternates participate as far as being up on what is going on and be able to step in if the primary representative is not able to function for whatever reason. Obviously, if there is input, there are ways and certainly opportunities for that information or that input to be conveyed, but it should go through the primary. And I think otherwise, this becomes a body of 60 rather than a fairly large group already.
Good point. Steve?
Yes, I take it that we're not talking about perhaps expanding the the voting, quote-unquote, pool to include alternates.
No.
And then secondly, and I don't know the answer to this, is how did the alternates, how were they determined? In other words, are they supported by the primaries? Is there direct continuity between the representation and the views of the alternates? That's a whole other layer of questions.
That's an excellent question. What is the logic behind selection of alternates, and what is the degree of linkage and affinity between primaries and alternates? It's a very fair question. Who would like to attempt to answer that?
I'm going to give that to John. I was in England during that time.
Mike tried to pull a Ted Turner when he founded CNN, took off on a worldwide cruise for a year, and came back and was up and running. Mike didn't quite do that, but he did go to England for 2 weeks. The current set of alternates, formally designated alternates, were selected by recommended by staff to the chair of the Blue Ribbon Task Force and the director of the Department of Fish and Game. They were by category, but those individuals were not vetted. That is, permission was not asked to recommend an alternate from the primary. And so in some cases, the person may say, gee, you know, that's a person that's from my same group, but I don't have a working relationship with them. The judgment was made that they represented the constituency. It was an important voice to get into the table. We've now solicited another round of nominations of alternates, and in some cases, individuals, primaries have said, I'd like to have this individual as an alternate. That's input. That's not determinative as we move forward. So this is a balancing act. We very much appreciate and want to support primaries and alternates working together. If that, in your judgment, and you're the primary or the alternate, is not working or not feasible, let us know, and we can make a judgment as we go forward. But we've not asked, in my judgment, individuals to designate their own alternate. We've solicited nominations, and including from the primaries, but others have made nominations also.
Jesus, question from you.
I'm wondering whether this might be your first opportunity for a straw vote.
I actually would like to caucus
I think
with staff.
No. I accept you can certainly make a recommendation, which we would carry forward to the appointing authorities, but the people in this room are not the appointing authorities, save Phil Eisenberg, who's looking at the ceiling at the moment.
Come back, Phil, come back.
All right, thank you. Good question, though. All right, protocol for lunch. The lunch is available for primary representatives and designated alternates. So there is a lunch protocol, and the lunch boxes are available behind us now. Right now. So let us adjourn, and we will reconvene at 1:30, and we'll pick up with reviewing our findings from the stakeholder interviews. Gentleman in the green?
Yes.
Thank you.
I'll be there in a minute.
Okay, thank you very much.
Steer your own.
Proportional vote. You guys have to clarify what that means, because otherwise you will assume that the caucuses, some of the non-principal, are entitled to cast independent votes.